Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, September 16th, 2022. This is the 23rd edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I am joined once again by Dr. Kevin Barrett, a leading 9/11 truth scholar, a popular and insightful geopolitical commentator, and a longtime contributor to American Free Press. All right, Dr. Kevin Barrett, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Great to be with you, John.
Yeah, thanks for joining me once again. We just sent issue 39 and 40 of American Free Press to the printer last night. So subscribers should be receiving their print edition sometime next week, and we covered a lot of important topics in this most recent edition as usual. And Dr. Barrett, I want to start off by discussing your article titled 9/11 Truth Movement Turns 21. Of course, the 21st anniversary of 9/11 was just this past Sunday, so almost a week ago, and you've been involved in the 9/11 Truth Movement for well over a decade, if I'm not mistaken. And I wanted to get started. I know I've asked you this before, and I've heard you talk about it in other programs, but just refresh my memory. When did you first start to question the official narrative, and what triggered that? Did you recognize the absurd nature of the official 9/11 conspiracy theory? Because that's exactly what it is, by the way. What the government and media tell us about 9/11 is itself a conspiracy theory. So did you recognize the fallacious nature of this official conspiracy theory promulgated by the mass media and the government from the very beginning, or did it take you a few years, or how did that come about?
Well, it took me a few years to realize just how outrageous the whole situation was and how overwhelming the evidence was proving that it was a false flag inside job, that the towers were blown up with explosives, and that the planes were not hijacked by humans. So I didn't realize all of that right away. But I was very suspicious from the get-go. I was actually teaching a folklore class at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the discussion section began, I think, at, what time would have that been? Maybe, 10 o'clock, if it would have been 10 o'clock Central, then that would have been, I guess, 11 Eastern.
Eastern, right.
Maybe it was 9 Central, 10 Eastern, something like that. And the students were all glued to their phones, following the developments. And of course, I'm still, even today in 2022, the last man on earth without a cell phone, or it feels like that sometimes. And at that time, of course, I didn't have one. So the students were sort of updating me. So the discussion section, which was supposed to be about folklore, ended up being about this bizarre news story erupting in New York and Washington. And I remember talking in that discussion section about how, oh, they're already saying Al-Qaeda. You know, that's very interesting. I said, Al-Qaeda, all of us in Middle Eastern studies know that Al-Qaeda is a joke. It's infiltrated by intelligence agencies. And if they're blaming Al-Qaeda for this, that's very suspicious. And Al-Qaeda was created by the United States and its allies to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And they continued to have total penetration of it afterwards. So, this is what I was telling the students at the time. And they were kind of didn't know what to think. And they were sort of saying, oh, really? Wow, that's strange. Well, this whole thing is very bizarre, et cetera, et cetera. So I was pretty skeptical right away. And I assumed, though, that probably there actually were hijackers, that they would have been brainwashed, and that the most likely suspects would have been the Israelis, because it was obvious to me, as it should have been obvious to anybody aware of foreign affairs and Middle Eastern affairs in particular, that Israel had the most to gain from this event by a long shot. And so from 2001 through the end of 2003, I was very busy finishing my dissertation. And so I didn't really have time to follow it closely and study it extensively. But during that whole period, I was highly suspicious, and I did see a lot of the early reports about reasons to be skeptical of the official story. But it wasn't really until the very end of 2003 when I heard that David Ray Griffin was saying that the towers and Building 7 had been blown up with explosives, and that whatever happened at the Pentagon, it wasn't struck by a hijacked airliner, that I decided to sit down and look into it. That was December. The semester had ended, so I had some free time, and I spent maybe a week looking into it very, very intensively, and was shocked at how obvious it was that this was a false flag and how outrageously the media was lying. And I've been pretty outraged ever since.
Right. Yeah, no, I sympathize with you. I mean, I have a little bit different story, obviously, but once I actually critically looked at what the government and media were telling us about 9/11, it was so obvious that the whole thing was a total insult, frankly. I mean, the idea that they would just expect everybody to go along with this totally absurd, not even plausible scenario is really sort of insulting and just outrageous to me. And so, yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I've sort of followed the 9/11 truth movement since. I mean, I really sort of woke up to it in like late 2009. So I was a few years, obviously, after you. But when I mean, when 9/11 happened, I was like, I think I was a sophomore in high school. So I wasn't really paying much attention to geopolitics and that sort of thing back then. But once I really took a second look at it and actually thought for myself and were, you know, started considering other ideas, considering quote-unquote 9/11 conspiracy theories, it became very, very obvious that what we were being told about 9/11 simply did not add up and was, in fact, insulting and just a total disrespect to any thinking person, and, you know, whether they're American or anywhere in the world, because pretty much every government has gone along with this totally ridiculous conspiracy theory. And, you know, I got to say, being involved in the 9/11 truth movement over the years, I think we've made a lot of progress, especially, you know, reflecting on it after, you know, the past 21 years. It's really opened the doors on so many other important topics and events that we've been lied to about. And I think pretty much everybody that I talk to that's in sort of like the 9/11 truth movement, they all say the same thing. Like, they started looking at 9/11 and then it opened up a door to maybe questioning World War II or questioning COVID or questioning the JFK assassination or any other number of topics that we've been lied to about. And it seems like there's a consensus that sort of developed among honest and serious thinkers that 9/11 was indeed a false flag style operation organized largely by Israel and the mostly Jewish neocons in the Bush administration, sort of working in tandem, of course, with the mass media and the intelligence agencies to kickstart this pre-planned global war on terrorism. I remember coming across a man named Dr. Alan Sabrowski years ago, who I've interviewed. I know you've interviewed him multiple times on your program. And, I mean, this is a very intelligent man. He was involved in the U.S. Marine Corps, I believe. He taught at the U.S. Army War College. You know, he looked at 9/11, analyzed the information, and clearly recognized that this was a sort of classic false flag operation that Mossad is very notorious for. Phil Giraldi, another former CIA counterterrorism analyst that also writes for American Free Press, has come to similar conclusions. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, another AFP contributor. You, of course, Dr. Jim Fetzer, many others. So, I mean, this is sort of like a consensus that's formed. And it's taken us a long time to get here. I mean, I remember jumping in the 9/11 truth movement and quickly sort of coming across the information by like Christopher Bolin, for example, in American Free Press. American Free Press was really on the front lines exposing the Israeli ties to 9/11. And this information was very controversial back then, even among, you know, the 9/11 truthers. So that's a very, very positive development in my mind. And I'm curious if you agree with that assessment or what you'd have to say in response.
Yeah, I think that assessment is basically correct. The people who are not afraid to point the finger at Israel because they are afraid of what that would do to their reputations and careers are largely pointing the finger at Israel. In my case, I was a little slow. Well, I wasn't slow in the sense that the day it happened, and from then on, I knew that Israel was the biggest winner. But once I discovered that it hadn't been done by simply brainwashing a bunch of Arab patsy hijackers, which I had assumed maybe the Israelis would do, but it was much more complex. It required the control of the American administration, top levels of the American military, intelligence apparatus, and the media, which at that time I didn't realize how big the Israeli influence on the media was. At that point, I was still blaming the CIA more than Israel for the JFK assassination. So at that point, once I saw David Ray Griffin's work, which was showing that the plane flights cannot, it wasn't real hijackers, and that there'd been a demolition at the Trade Center, I assumed that the complexity of that and the cover-up would have required a lot of American high-level participation, or at least acquiescence. And so I started seeing it more as an American inside job than an Israeli outside job, or at least equally. And from that point on, I tried to be kind of neutral and, kind of balance those perspectives, not denying that Israel had the most to gain and that it has a lot of influence in the U.S., but at the same time pointing fingers at all kinds of high-level Americans, whether Dick Cheney or Richard Myers, who was the acting head of the Joint Chiefs that day, the CIA at the time, and so on, all seemed to be complicit. Then I noticed that even though I was not talking about Israel, especially after I was dragged on Fox News and covered by the mainstream media beginning in June of 2006, as I was made sort of the whipping boy and example of what could happen to you if you're a professor who talks about this. Once I was getting all that mainstream publicity, I was really not talking about Israel very much. It was more, Israel was sort of the second priority, and the first priority was talking about the obvious complicity of the U.S. military and intelligence apparatus and the Bush-Cheney administration, or I should say the Cheney-Bush administration. But even so, just talking about the evidence for the false flag nature of 9/11 brought down a lot of heat from Zionists. And for example, in 2006, my Wikipedia page went up and was quite positive, or at least neutral and reasonable, for a little while. And then suddenly I started getting somebody was posting that I was a friend of Holocaust deniers. And at that time, I didn't know anything about the Holocaust issue. And I didn't even know, I'd never heard of two of the three people that they were accusing me of being a friend or associated with and supporter of. And then the third one was David Irving, and I'd heard his name, but I didn't know anything about him. So this was a total lie, and yet it couldn't be removed from my Wikipedia page for about 5 years. Every time somebody would try to remove it, it would pop back up almost automatically, like they had some kind of software doing it. And that made me really wonder what was going on, and that and all sorts of other indications that the people pushing back hardest against 9/11 truth were all partisans of Israel.
That should make you think, right? Okay, why are these guys so against anybody questioning the official narrative? Well, for me, I mean, one of the most astonishing aspects I quickly discovered this after maybe a week or two of looking into 9/11, was the fact, and this is proven by police records, by police reports, by FBI reports, sources coming directly from the government, that the only people actually arrested on 9/11 were individuals tied to Israel's military and Israel's Mossad. And I'm thinking, okay, the government's going on and on about how Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, organized 9/11 and sort of, hated us for our freedoms and all this other nonsense. Meanwhile, the only people that were actually arrested that seemed to have foreknowledge, that seemed to know what was going on, were these Israeli spies. Why is nobody talking about that? Why is it anti-Semitic to point that out when it's just a basic fact that these individuals were in fact arrested, were very suspicious? In fact, going back to American Free Press, we interviewed one of the officers that was involved in arresting these gentlemen in New Jersey, and it was very clear that they definitely knew what was going on, and they were celebrating and laughing. And then, of course, I'm sure most people listening are familiar with the quote-unquote dancing Israelis. They go back over to Israel. They're basically not even really investigated by our own law enforcement intelligence agencies. They're sort of whisked back to Israel at the behest of Michael Chertoff, who happened to have deep connections to Israel, as a Jewish individual that was at the Department of Justice in the Bush administration, who later went on to become the first head of the Department of Homeland Security. And he's basically letting these guys off and go back over to Israel without really investigating them, when clearly they were tied into what was going on. So just that fact alone, that our own government arrested these people and they knew that there was something shady going on, and they were just let back to Israel because, you know, apparently even investigating these people is quote-unquote anti-Semitic, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I did see some of this information about the dancing Israelis, the massive Israeli spy operation that was run against the United States beginning at about the beginning of 2001, and that surveilled the alleged hijackers, or these patsies that they were setting up to take the blame as hijackers, were under total surveillance, apparently, from some of these hundreds of Mossad people who swarmed all over America during that period. It's now regarded as the biggest foreign intelligence operation ever mounted against the United States within the United States. And so I saw that stuff. There was a book about that by Justin Raimondo, which got some play in the Counterpunch website. Alex Coburn was running Counterpunch at the time, and despite his extreme aversion to 9/11 conspiracy theories, he noticed that this was really interesting stuff. And so I saw that again. That was during that 2001 to 2003, four period before I saw David Ray Griffin's work. I was assuming that this could have been a Mossad outside job, totally without that much complicity from the inside. And then again, there's the anthrax aspect as well. And the Hartford Courant made it clear that it's a mainstream publication, and they published information about what was going on at Fort Detrick that made it clear that this false flag anthrax attack, which killed several people and shut down the U.S. Congress and helped grease the skids for the Patriot Act by terrorizing the two biggest obstacles to the passage of the Patriot Act, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, that anthrax attack was perpetrated most likely by a man named Philip Zack. And the story was that there was a fight between Philip Zack, who's Jewish and rabidly Zionist, and an Egyptian American Muslim, Dr. Assad, that apparently he had gone through channels to try to stop this Zionist harassment of him over his ethnicity and religion. And Philip Zack was the key perpetrator, apparently. And as it turned out, the circumstantial evidence strongly pointed towards Zack having done this, because Zack pointed the finger at Assad, tried to blame him for these attacks at a time when only the perpetrator could have known there was an attack. That's at least the version as I recall. So there was that evidence as well. And of course, whoever sent the anthrax mailings was obviously trying to fan the flames of Islamophobia from a Zionist perspective. The envelopes containing anthrax had scrawled on them, "Death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great."
yeah, very much. I mean, directly related to – it was like basically like another aspect of the overall 9/11 operation and the propaganda associated with it to kickstart this global war on terrorism against quote-unquote radical Islamic extremism, whatever that means. I mean, you know, it's basically all part of this pre-concocted script, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that script actually was set in stone as early as 1979 at the JCIT conference in Jerusalem, organized by Netanyahu in honor of his brother, who had died in the Entebbe airport false flag. That is a hijacking that the Israeli authorities actually encouraged and covertly arranged for. And so this conference was all about how terrorism would be set up as the next civilizational enemy after the demise of communism, apparently. So they planned to sort of merge the specters of communism and terrorism, and then steer it towards terrorism being the great enemy. And of course, that was very convenient for Israel, which could then label the ethnicity or ethnicities and religion that were causing Israel the biggest problem as so-called terrorists. And that 1979 was an interesting year. That's when the U.S. created Al-Qaeda to fight as the U.S. Arab Legion against the Russians in Afghanistan. And then it's also the year of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And that, I think, scared a lot of people. And so they saw that, you know, the Islamic awakening was having a lot of effects, that the leading intellectual edge of the Islamic awakening, as represented by people like Imam Khomeini in Iran, was very anti-Zionist and anti-imperialist. And there were going to be problems in the future for Israel and also for, you know, for the West, to the extent that the West wants to be colonizing, lording it over the Muslim lands. So that plan was set in motion in 1979 at the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism. And it Netanyahu was a key player even that early. And so it was very interesting that Netanyahu then kind of came back in time to preside over the aftermath of 9/11.
Yeah, very, very convenient for him, wasn't it? Right. Well, yeah, I've come to view the formulation of this idea of a global war on terrorism, which you correctly point out was, you know, basically started going all the way back to the late 1970s, early 1980s, by these Israeli geopolitical strategists and also the Jewish neocons in America. They basically concocted this paradigm of international relations to replace the Cold War paradigm, right? I mean, that's basically what happened. And they needed a catalyzing event, which they openly write about in some of their documents, the PNAC document, for example. So, you know, it's just so obvious what 9/11 was all about at this point. It's really been firmly established that this was a false flag operation designed to kickstart and sort of institutionalize this global war on terror paradigm that advances Israel's geopolitical interests in the Middle East using American and other Western nations' military might and economic might.
That's true. Yeah, it was sort of a, you know, you could see it as a parasite hijacking a larger creature, like that the famous one with toxoplasmosis, I think it's called, that hijacks the brains of mice and causes them to develop a real affection for the smell of cats. And so the mice come out of their holes and go, you know, go up to the nearest cat. Hearts swirling around their heads like a cartoon, one of those cat and mouse cartoons. The cat eats the mouse, and then the parasitical organism goes through the next stage of its life cycle. And so, yeah, in a sense, it's like, you know, Israel is this parasite that devours the brain of the host and then turns its big, powerful host towards its own ends, which in this case would be the destruction of Israel's enemies. And that's precisely what happened after 9/11. The U.S. was hijacked, the U.S. military was hijacked, and it went to war first in Afghanistan, which was probably more defensible from an American imperial perspective, since Afghanistan is the middle of the grand chessboard in the struggle against the entities that really matter to the U.S., which is Russia and China, and then went into Iraq. Some argue that one of the reasons for the Afghan invasion was to put military bases on that side of Iran. And then by invading Iraq, that meant Iraq was totally surrounded, or Iran was totally surrounded. And Iran is the biggest problem for the Zionists. But Iraq was a pretty big problem, too. Saddam Hussein was supporting Palestinian resistance. And essentially what 9/11 was really all about was rearranging the regional countries, redrawing the map, totally changing the overall situation. And that's what Netanyahu's think tank had called for in 1996 in its Clean Break document, which was authored by essentially the same neocons who then would write the 2000 PNAC document that you mentioned, Rebuilding America's Defenses, which called for a new Pearl Harbor exactly 1 year before 9/11. So right. The 1996 Clean Break document said Israel needs to transcend its enemies, not just beat them, but actually transcend them by utterly changing the entire landscape in the region. And the best way to do that is to overthrow their regime in Baghdad and to engage in a series of regime changes. Now, they obviously knew that that wasn't going to happen anytime soon, absent that cataclysmic and catalyzing event such as a new Pearl Harbor that then they would call for in a couple more years in their PNAC document. So this was all about totally destroying the region, destroying Israel's enemies. And I think they dreamed that they could somehow rebuild U.S. occupied total, you know, controlled colonies in the region and force them to all be very friendly to Israel. At least that was the propaganda line. I'm not sure if they were stupid enough to actually believe that. But frankly, it seems to me that the plan may very well have been to simply destroy the region, which is essentially what happened. They utterly trashed Iraq, utterly trashed Libya, utterly trashed Somalia, broke Sudan into two pieces and caused no end of mayhem in Lebanon, utterly destroyed Syria. And so basically the whole region is just, you know, is crushed. The difference between the way the region is today due to these 9/11 wars and what it would have been absent the 9/11 wars is just staggering.
Right. And this is all part of the Israeli military strategist Oded Yanon, his plan going back, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that came out in the late 1970s or early 1980s, correct? And,
yeah,
and he was, yeah, he was basically arguing that the entire region needed to be the sort of sophisticated modern Arab states needed to be broken down and basically promote ethnic rivalries and create civil wars and this sort of thing to weaken these larger states so that way Israel could basically dominate the region. And that's essentially what has happened over the course of the past 20 years or more.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, they've tried to balkanize the whole region along ethnic and sectarian lines and stir up the sectarian hatreds as much as possible. And that has been a big part of what's been going on in Iraq. I noticed this early on after the U.S. invasion in 2003, when, of course, they put Israelis in charge of Abu Ghraib and other aspects of this covert war on Iraq, because it wasn't just the U.S. invasion, but there was also a systematic extermination of literally thousands of Iraq's brightest minds. That is, the technocratic elite in Iraq was systematically exterminated in murders by Zionist-directed black ops people. And of course, John Israel, the Israeli, was the man who taught those foolish American soldiers to restage the works of the Marquis de Sade in Abu Ghraib. So the Israelis took charge of the destruction of Iraq, and they were most likely involved in, if not the actual act, certainly the policy of stirring up sectarian hatred through propaganda and through false flag attacks. The Golden Dome was one of the famous targets of a false flag attack. They would send in terrorists to attack the Sunnis and get them to blame the Shia and vice versa. And for a while, it wasn't obvious that it was going to work. But eventually, by simply this relentless campaign of fostering sectarian terror, it did actually create a sectarian divide that hadn't existed before. And so even today, that's part of the role of ISIS or Daesh, which is a U.S.-created terror death squad. Negroponte went over to Iraq to create ISIS. Negroponte has created these death squads all over the world, most famously in Central America, these death squads that carry out Operation Phoenix-type mass killings as basically what it's just what they do. And so he was there when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the ostensible head of ISIS, was in U.S. captivity for 4 years being trained to create ISIS. And the U.S. military lied and said they only had him for something like 6 months. And multiple witnesses say that's not true, that he was in U.S. custody both at Abu Ghraib and at, I think it was Bagram, for more like 4+ years. And while he was there, even the official story in the mainstream media is that al-Baghdadi created ISIS or Daesh while he was in U.S. captivity. Now, how could that happen if they didn't want it to happen? And I would argue that it wasn't just that they wanted it. They spent 4.5 years creating Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and creating Daesh. And they've used Daesh to attack their enemies in places like Syria and indeed in Iraq, where the pro-Iran militias are attacked. But they also use it just to stir up all kinds of destabilization and random terror to keep the country in chaos. And they finally, the most important perhaps part of Daesh is creating a negative image of Islam. You know, that when people see these crazy head choppers behaving in such ways, you know, taking these drugs that they were probably taught to take by their American trainers, and being incredibly sadistic and brutal, it makes Islam look bad, right? If these are Islamic, if these are the most extreme Islamic people, then what, you know, whatever they're representing must be terrible. And that, of course, was one of the purposes of the whole creation of Al-Qaeda and other so-called extremist groups as well, which the Saudi king, by the way, or the current the crown prince or clown prince, as some of us call him, actually has come right out and admitted that the extremism problem was totally done by the U.S., that the Saudis participated in it as a favor to the United States in its geopolitical objectives. So he's on the record saying that this entire radical Islam thing that came out of Saudi Arabia that you're blaming us for, you're the one that created it, and we helped you create it, and we did that for your geopolitical benefit. And
well, the thing is you can't. I don't even think it's accurate to really say your like American geopolitical interest, because this in no way benefits America. This is basically designed to advance Israel's interests. I mean, Israel and its agents have totally hijacked America and have used America to advance their own unique political interests. So, I mean, hearing you explain all this, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think there's a lot. Pretty much, your analysis is spot on. And I couldn't think of a more counterproductive, harmful policy to pursue as an American. I mean, this makes no sense. This in no way advances America's interests in the region or in the world or anywhere.
Well, you know, the thing is, the U.S. would have to have a very different policy if it weren't controlled by Zionists. And so if we imagine this alternate world where the U.S. is not captive to Zionism, you know, let's imagine a world where the American authorities had managed to stop or prosecute the killers of JFK and recognize that it was a Mossad job. And then the U.S. had pursued a very anti-Israeli policy after that, perhaps even ended the state of Israel. Then we might have a very different kind of U.S. Mideast policy in which the U.S. would basically be the benevolent protector of these countries against possible threats from Russia. Russia has always been interested in warm water ports. And so, and then, of course, there's also the, you know, India versus Pakistan at that other edge of the region. The U.S. could have been a kind of a neutral arbiter whose main would have mainly been kind of protecting these relatively weaker countries in the Middle East against possible predation from stronger entities in return for a modest concession in terms of oil pricing and so on. And that would have been a normal kind of U.S. policy. It would have involved a certain amount of what we might call, you know, imperialist exploitation, because, of course, the U.S. would have wanted the best possible deal on all of that oil. But the overall picture would have been much more benevolent, and there would have been a much more positive relationship between the U.S. and these genuinely independent Middle Eastern countries. So that's an alternate world hypothesis of what we would have if the Zionists hadn't captured power in the United States. But they did. They got away with killing Kennedy. They got away with the USS Liberty in 1967. They got away with 9/11. They have been providing nearly half of the funding to American political campaigns of both parties. It used to be they provided about a half, or rather a third of the funding for the Republicans and about a half for the Democrats. And now it may be flipped. But in any case, the Zionists have essentially taken over control of U.S. Mideast policy, among other things. And in that world, where the U.S. is de facto, you know, Israel's biggest supporter, and the congressmen leap to their feet and give standing ovations every time Netanyahu sneezes, in that world, obviously, the U.S. policy in the region is going to be far from benevolent, because it's opposed to the wishes of the 90% of the region that recognizes that there's a genocide going on in Palestine and wants to stop it. So in the real world, U.S. policy in the Middle East has been very bellicose and opposed to the aspirations of the people of the region, creating a split between the rulers, who tend to have to acquiesce to the U.S. and to some extent to the Zionists, and the people, who don't want to acquiesce. And so it's been very chaotic. But again, in the real world, the difference between U.S. policy and Israeli policy in the region isn't really very big, and it certainly should be. I mean, there shouldn't be any such convergence, but historically there is, because the Zionists have essentially taken over American policy.
Right. And it's been a total disaster for America, for the Middle East, and really for the entire world. But I want to turn and talk more about your article that was published in the most recent edition of American Free Press. It's on page 5, and it's titled, 9/11 Truth Movement Turns 21, Search for What Really Happened on 9/11 Awakened a Sleeping Nation. And in the article, you argue that the 9/11 Truth Movement founded internet-based information activism. It rocked the world in unprecedented ways. Never before had so many people lost so much faith in their leaders so quickly. And boy, that certainly describes my mindset once I came across 9/11 Truth. And I think you're right that it really did sort of revolutionize internet-based information activism. And it became very effective, so effective, in fact, that now we see big tech censoring, deplatforming. We've got guys like Cass Sunstein and his ilk in the federal law enforcement and intelligence communities, cognitively infiltrating online groups. And, you know, basically, I think their main strategy has largely revolved around spreading gossip and rumors, creating and stirring division, and generally causing drama, basically, in what otherwise could be productive and intelligent group chats or comment boards or discussion forums. And I've certainly seen this play out over the course of the past 15 years or so, just looking, you know, going online, going on social media, going in comment sections, and you can almost like tell now who's, you know, acting in bad faith and who's like genuinely trying to have a productive conversation, even if there's disagreements and analysis or, you know, a debate raging or whatever. You can tell that there's been an active campaign to disrupt this and to sort of throw a wrench in the truth movement, in the truth community, right?
Absolutely. And that's what Cass Sunstein told us he was going to do when he and Adrian Vermeule published their article, Conspiracy Theories, Causes and Cures. I believe it was first published in 2007. And their thesis was that 9/11 truth was so dangerous that someday it might be necessary to outlaw conspiracy theories such as 9/11 truth.
Sounds like the Holocaust denial laws that we see in Europe, right?
Yeah, well, that's true. There already are laws against such things in many countries. And he said that we can't do that all at once. And so at present, what the government should do is cognitively infiltrate conspiracy groups in order to promote, quote, beneficial cognitive diversity, which would thereby, quote, disable the purveyors of conspiracy theories. You know, it sounds like a bunch of sort of bizarre mumbo jumbo. And, you know, a benevolent interpretation of cognitively infiltrate would be to spread beneficial cognitive diversity would be, oh, we want to get these conspiracy theorists interested in something other than 9/11. You know, they spend too much time on 9/11. It's not good for their brains. You know, it's sort of like today, the things they're saying about the election denying Trump supporters, right? Such people become very dangerous, yada, yada, yada. So we need to, you know, to help them. And we need to maybe they need a hobby. They should take up stamp collecting, or they should talk about sports, or they should talk about shopping or whatever. They need to be cognitively diverse, right? Stop thinking so much about 9/11. But no, that's not what he meant. By beneficial cognitive diversity, what he meant was beneficial to the authorities. And the kind of cognitive diversity he was talking about was, let's get these guys talking about flat earth theory along with 9/11, or, you know, Elvis survived and was, you know, kidnapped by aliens and taken to Mars and is living with Hitler in Paraguay today. So this sort of, you know, this insane stuff, and also people fighting, you know, beneficial cognitive diversity. It's beneficial to the authorities when people in the 9/11 truth movement have extreme cognitive diversity about, let's say, what happened at the Pentagon or precisely how the World Trade Center was demolished, and people get very angry at each other and scream at each other. Yeah, that's the kind of beneficial cognitive diversity. He was talking about that in Flat Earth. And that's what the government has done. And they've also gone a ways towards the ultimate goal of outlawing conspiracy theories by demonizing them to such an extent that today all of these big media and internet companies are really pushing hard to sort of purge them, you know, purge unorthodox perspectives from the internet. And we see that since about 2015 or so, right about coinciding with the arrival of Donald Trump, we see this extreme pushback and this beginning of horrific internet censorship that nobody could ever imagine 15, 20 years ago could ever happen. We just assumed that the Communications Decency Act made it absolutely mandatory for every platform, as opposed to a publisher, to give equal access to everybody who uses the platform, and know that you're not, you know, they weren't allowed to encourage one perspective over another, much less actually remove anything or censor anything that wasn't illegal. Because if they did that, they would be editing their content, which would make them a publisher rather than a platform. A platform is like the telephone company. Anybody can say anything they want, and nobody's allowed to spy on you, and nobody is certainly allowed to tell you what you can and can't say over the phone. Nobody is allowed to give you worse phone service because they don't like your ideas, and give better phone service to the people whose ideas they support. That would be completely un-American. But that's exactly what they're doing now on the internet. And nobody ever could have imagined that that would be possible. We all assumed under the Communications Decency Act of, I think it was like 1996, and the Constitution, that it was that all internet users get exactly the same deal in all platforms, and only a publisher who is actually carefully evaluating the content that they put on their platform, or rather on their public, in their publication, such as American Free Press, which has the right, obviously, to publish what they want to publish, and to take any views they want, and to suppress or not publish anything that they don't like. American Free Press can do that because it's a publisher, but that means that if American Free Press were to publish anything libelous, it could be sued by the person who thinks they've been libeled. And these internet platforms couldn't possibly survive if they were publishers, because there's so much stuff that gets posted there, they can't really keep track of it. And so there would be a million lawsuits blossoming immediately if they lost their protection under the Communications Decency Act. And unfortunately, this the whole legal framework shifted radically in about 2015. Before that, everybody assumed that all platforms had to be content neutral. You can't favor anything. You can't censor anything. You can't give anybody a better deal or a push. It's like the telephone. And post-2015, after a concerted push by the bad guys, in think tanks and such, pushing stuff into the media saying, oh, actually, it's okay to censor the internet, suddenly it flipped. And today, internet censorship is pretty much everywhere. I mean, all of these big platforms are massively censoring people. And it's really hurt those of us who are trying to get these important but suppressed perspectives into the conversation.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, you have another excerpt I want to read here from your recent article. And you sort of talk about how the internet was back in 2001 and sort of leading, I guess, you know, basically leading up to 2015, when this very censorship heavy approach was taken by big tech and by the government. You say in 2001, internet users had not yet been corralled, surveilled, and censored by big tech. They were free to share their views through email. Spam had not yet crippled mass emailing. Alternative news websites were honestly represented in search engines. Information discrediting the official version of 9/11 was widely available, and the shocked internet users who discovered it were motivated to spread the word. And again, that perfectly describes me back when I was first sort of waking up to 9/11 in 2009, 2010. And, you know, as we've sort of been discussing, internet censorship has only increased dramatically over the years, and ironically under former President Trump. It perhaps reached its height under his administration, as entire websites have been shut down, banned, deplatformed. YouTube, which was once sort of like the Wild West in the information struggle, where anyone could find information about any and all topics, has basically been transformed into yet another arm of mainstream media. I don't know if you've been on YouTube lately, but I mean, you know, you have basically ads on every video now. It's all, you know, it's very, very censored. It's difficult to keep a channel or to keep a, you know, a platform on YouTube if you're questioning COVID or 9/11 or any other controversial topic. I mean, you get banned very quickly, or have a strike on your channel, for example, where you have to remove the video. So it's been very much corralled and censored. And I mean, I myself, I had a, when I first started like 9/11 activism, I started a blog using Blogger, Google's free Blogger platform. And that's been entirely erased. Like, I can't even access it anymore. It's been banned for quote-unquote hate speech. I've been banned and deplatformed from PayPal, from Stripe, from Facebook. When I was on Facebook, I, you know, like every other day I would be getting banned on Facebook, so I just gave it up. So yeah, it's been a real struggle, and there have been way worse examples than just what I listed. I'm just giving you my personal experience. I mean, the Daily Stormer, for example, love him or hate him, agree with him or not, I mean, his entire website has been stolen from him, essentially. And that's not right. I mean, everybody should be able to express themselves, especially if they're paying for a website and hosting services.
Yeah, and actually, I think Anglin is wildly caricatured in a pretty, you know, insane way by the mainstream, which would, you know, makes him out as the second coming of Hitler, when in fact he's really just a kind of acerbic, ironic prankster. In a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of playfulness and humor and self-parody even in what Anglin does. And it's really almost the joke is on the authorities for taking it seriously. Like, you know, he'll say things that are at least half ironic. And the authorities think that he's like a real, you know, Nazi who wants to exterminate every Jew or something like that.
Well, he is a master troll. He knows how to get under these people's skin and do it in a very effective and funny and often funny way. And he's a great writer. He's very insightful. I don't always agree with everything he says, but I totally support his right to say it. And, you know, what's happened to him. And there's been some other websites, some other individuals that have had similar things happen. I mean, it's just outrageous. And, you know, it's a topic you address in the article. You know, now the new and you actually mentioned this in the article. Now the excuse for internet censorship, you know, this idea that, you know, MAGA Republicans and Republican fascism is threatening democracy. That's sort of the new excuse. Of course, COVID basically was the key justifier for shutting down any sort of dissent about the overall pandemic, about the skepticism of vaccines. I mean, and you argue now that there's basically a draconian U.S. national security state censorship regime that ensures that quote unquote dangerous posts and videos are shadow banned or outright scrubbed. And I think that, you know, basically accurately characterizes the information environment today. Although I do have to say that there are alternative platforms. Rumble, for example, Odyssey is, you know, another video sharing website. People can still set up websites and blogs and video channels and create their own podcasts. But you have to go out of your way to access this stuff. You can't share a lot of this stuff on the big mainstream social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, for example. So they've just made it a lot more difficult to get this information out. And you almost have to go out of your way to access it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the intention. In other words, they're not totally banning us yet. Instead, they're trying to corral us off into a so-called free speech zone. Remember those free speech zones that they came up with at the political conventions in 2004 when the Iraq War was becoming very unpopular, the Truth Movement was rising, and people went to the Republican and Democratic National Conventions to protest with 9/11 truth signs and things like that. I actually got to speak to Jesse Ventura at the, I believe it was the 2004, was it, convention? I think it was 2008. Anyway, they would create a free speech zone. So the protesters couldn't go right up in front of the building where the convention was being held. Instead, they would have to go to a vacant lot, maybe three or four blocks or six blocks down the street. And then they would put a bunch of sort of barbed wire around a vacant lot, wallet the whole thing off, and there's like one entrance, and you go into this like vacant lot, and that's the so-called free speech zone where you can stand there with your signs and nobody can see you. So that's what they're trying to do to us on the internet now. They're trying to make sure that the normal people never see what we have there for them. And that's, you know, they saw that with 9/11, it was so easy for people who discovered the evidence against the official story to share it with people who didn't know that yet. And now they want to make sure that the people who are not exposed to these ideas, that is, they hope the majority, the people using Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and so on, these big platforms, they'll be kept sort of quarantined off away from the dangerous, you know, disease-bearing conspiracy theorists who will be quarantined in these platforms for other people who think like them, And so so we're stuck with these other platforms. Now, of all these platforms, I've noticed Rumble seems to be pretty effective at getting a lot of views. But again, of course, it's mostly people who already are exposed to these kinds of ideas. And then Substack is actually my favorite platform right now. And I do have a Substack at kevinbarrett.substack.com. And Substack seems to be especially geared towards writers who are questioning things. They are very strong in their commitment to free speech. So until they sell out and take $1 billion and go off to retire on an island or something like that, Substack will be a pretty good platform. So if you start subscribing to dissident Substacks, you'll find other ones. And there's a lot of good material there. It's really become, I think, the best platform currently.
Yeah, I agree. Substack is very good. There's a lot of good material. It's basically like you can almost set up your own blog, you know, using Substack. And I mean, I support that totally. The one thing that I noticed, though, is that in order to monetize it, you have to be able to use Stripe. And for people like me who've been totally banned from Stripe, it's, you know, it's basically a non-starter, right? I mean, I wouldn't even be able to jump on there and actually, you know, create a paid subscription feature because I've been banned from Stripe. So in that sense, it's kind of disappointing, but it is a good platform. I agree. There's a lot of great writers, a lot of dissident writers that you wouldn't really encounter elsewhere. And it's structured well, it's easy to read, it's easy to navigate. So I do agree. It is a good platform. And I wanted to make a point just about the internet in general, sort of over the years that I've noticed. It's sort of like a double-edged sword, right? I mean, on the one hand, it allows individuals to access incredible amounts of information. I mean, in that aspect, it's very revolutionary. It allows us, you know, unlimited access to information, essentially, if you know how to use it, right? We can share ideas and perspectives and narratives that are totally excluded by the establishment, by the media, by the academic world, by the political establishment, and really engage in political or historical or social discussion on any topic, essentially. It also creates information overload, on the other hand, and it makes it difficult to navigate all this information and to, you know, sort of truly figure out who's telling the truth. There's a lot of nonsense and even outright disinformation out there. And, you know, love him or hate him, Alex Jones, another pretty controversial individual, his motto for InfoWars is so spot on and so precise. It's a very precise way of looking at the average internet user and citizen and, you know, sort of what we're up against. And his motto is, there's a war on for your mind. And the question that must be asked, everybody must ask themselves this question, are you as an individual going to think for yourself? Are you going to think critically and independently, consider alternative ideas and perspectives, and come to your own conclusions? Or are you going to let the mass media, big tech, the government, and academia do the thinking for you and just accept what they say, even after they've been totally exposed for lying about the most game-changing events in modern history, such as 9/11, or even, you know, more recently, this alleged COVID pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the COVID pandemic, you know, I think that the COVID dissident movement needs to really focus on COVID origins and wake up to the geopolitical side of COVID and the fact that freedom is threatened primarily by not just by, you know, corporate capitalism and so on, and the oligarchy, but by the national security state that is, I think, trying to regiment us in order to get ready for a possible World War III. You know, if we look at 9/11, I think the more productive way to look at it as a geopolitical game that was primarily driven by the geopolitical interests of Israel. And I think with COVID, it appears that COVID probably originated in a U.S. biowar strike on China and Iran for, of course, geopolitical purposes. Iran has been targeted mainly by the Zionists, and China is a threat to the interests of the U.S. oligarchy that wants to continue to rule without the kinds of constraints that Chinese oligarchs are faced with when they try to influence their government policy. I mean, love or hate the Chinese government, and you know, I'm pretty neutral. I think they're pretty competent, but I certainly wouldn't want to live there under such a ultra collectivist kind of setup. But it seems to me that, like Russia, China even more so has developed a central state with public banking, which means that the commanding heights of their society and their economy are occupied by a group of mandarins. They call themselves the Communist Party. They're really not all that communist anymore. They're just mandarins who are, they want to keep control of their society in order to make it work for themselves, but also for the average person. And they know that the biggest threat is the power of corrupt gangster type oligarchs, like those who completely rule the West. And so our system here in the United States has gotten taken over by these gangster oligarchs. And disproportionately, they happen to be Jewish Zionists. You know, maybe 40-50% of them are Jewish. And almost all of those billionaire Jews who are, you know, half of the American oligarchy have some kind of commitment to the state of Israel. But essentially, our system allows these politically interested billionaire oligarchs to seize complete control. There's almost no pushback from ordinary people, nor from anybody who has the interests of ordinary people at heart. Now, maybe Donald Trump does a little bit, Bernie Sanders does a little bit, but they're really kind of, you know, proverbially urinating in the wind as these gangster billionaire oligarchs can buy up political power and hijack our government. They basically own the government. The government is basically just a private security force for these billionaire oligarchs in the U.S. and Western systems. And so geopolitically, I think what COVID was about was these oligarchs are threatened by the rise of the BRICS nations, especially China with its booming economy thanks to its public banking. And they know that they are not going to rule the world in the one world state that they would like to have, unless they can find a way to really mess with China and prevent its continuing economic rise and technological rise. So I think that's where COVID comes from. COVID was a neocon biological strike against Wuhan. They made it a false flag because they set China up. The U.S. military games black ops guys probably uncorked COVID at the wet market so they could blame those Chinese bat soup slurpers. And then their fallback plan is to blame the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And that, of course, was put there with American money, and specifically the bat coronavirus program put there by BioWar suspect Peter Daszak and his friends, is to set China up for this false flag. So the government of Iran has formally accused the United States of unleashing COVID in a biological strike against China and Iran. The government of Russia has now made essentially the same accusation as of last week. And the chair of the COVID Commission, which is the equivalent of the 9/11 Commission, has said that he thinks COVID came out of an American lab. You might as well say a biowar lab. And he says there's a monstrous cover-up of the COVID origins issue, and that these biowar criminals who pushed the natural origin theory originally are lying to him. That's Jeffrey Sachs. So given this situation, I really think that the COVID dissident movement should unrelentingly be hammering at the COVID origin issue, because this comes out of the U.S. $100 billion biowar program, and we need to end biowar programs or they're going to end us. It's really that simple. And so what COVID really should be teaching us is that, you know, war is the health of the state. If you don't like censorship, you don't like your freedom being stripped away, if you don't like being injected with vaccines against the latest virus that the biowarriors are attacking their adversaries with, you need to expose this and put an end to the entire multinational biowar industry.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with that. It's been, nothing good can come out of these biowarfare labs, that's for sure. And actually, there's just basically two final topics I want to kind of wrap up with. In your piece, you argue that sort of like an American or maybe like a more broader Western military defeat or economic collapse would sort of speed things up and, you know, lead to the downfall of this like totally unipolar, America-dominated world order. that has been running the world essentially since World War II, to the detriment of virtually the entire world, I should point out, including the American people. And as you're sort of noting, Russia and China and their allies, the BRICS nations, and some of these other countries are increasingly challenging this unjust world order. And, you know, I look at it like, I mean, you know, you look at the way things have been run since World War II and the establishment of this unipolar world order. And it's basically a system that only benefits the globalists, the elite one percenters, the Klaus Schwabs, Bill Gates, Haim Sabans of the world, essentially, as well as the Zionist regime's geopolitical interests in the Middle East at the expense of everyone else. So, I mean, that to me is the main geopolitical issue of our time. Are we going to continue to allow this totally illegitimate, unjust, unipolar world order to continue to dominate the world and basically ruin the lives of millions of people, billions of people, I should say? Or are we going to see an alternative to this system emerge, which, you know, in desperation, we see like the Biden regime, for example, and the Western elite, you know, desperately trying to prevent?
Yeah, well, we need to save the American Republic. And I think that is, as U.S. Americans, we're living in a country that has no real ethnic core. I mean, yeah, the white nationalists wish it did. And yeah, I agree that maybe we're demographically changing too fast for our own good. And maybe we need to slow down immigration and things like that. Yeah, I'm on board halfway with that. But I think we are not really an ethno state. We're really an ideological state. And the ideology that's reigning here, for better or worse, comes out of the Enlightenment and is enshrined in the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights. We're really supposed to be a republic. And, you know, and some of that, I think, is really good. We have a lot of good traditions, anti-militarist traditions. We're not even supposed to have a standing army, and certainly anti-imperialist traditions. We were born in revolt against the world's biggest empire. And we, you know, we have that republican form of government, or we're supposed to, but it's been usurped gradually, but really pretty quickly after World War II, by this imperial state that is under the control of a globalist oligarchical billionaire elite. And I think as we frame our struggle in terms of, you know, we're not partisans of China, we're not partisans of Russia or partisans of Iran or partisans of these other countries that want to have independence and autonomy and sovereignty. We're partisans of the American Republic, which has been the biggest victim of the American, call it the Anglo-Zionist Empire. Some people call it the American Empire, but whatever you want to call it, it's not the system that our founding fathers set up. It's not the system that really would benefit us. We could actually have a pretty decent system. Philosophically, I'm not fully on board with the American system. I would debate whether it's actually the best way of thinking about governance. However, I will admit that it has a lot of good points. It has a pretty good history overall, and it's tragic that it was overthrown after World War II, and that this gulag state, this kind of, you know, hidden gulag state with just off the charts international crime by this gangster oligarchy and creating what they want to be a one world empire has taken it over. So I think restoring the republic and ending the empire really has to be the order of the day.
Yes, I would agree with that. And it seems like, and we'll wrap up with this, but it seems to me that, like, for example, with this recent Biden speech where he was denouncing MAGA Republicans, which Don Jeffries actually wrote about in American Free Press, I should mention. It seems like, you know, with an example like this, like the ruling elite, the Biden regime, the media, these globalist institutions are just increasingly desperate and have recognized that their control over the narrative, their economic and military dominance, and just like their overall power in general, I guess, are rapidly eroding. Did you see the UN, the World Jewish Congress, and the European Commission? They collaborated and launched that social media campaign designed to prevent the spread of conspiracy theories about COVID and Israel. And they even specifically said the Rothschilds and George Soros. I mean, they do not want anyone questioning or thinking critically about the information they are consuming. They, you know, it's so obvious. They prefer a totally mindless, class of automatons that will just regurgitate what they're told, never question anything, and just continue to be a slave to this ruling elite. And I think all of that has changed over the years. I think 9/11 truth played a key role, which I think is, you know, why it's so important, why I still like talking about 9/11 and what the truth movement has accomplished over the years. But yeah, I mean, do you want to comment on that as we sort of wrap up? It seems like there is a very real sense of desperation among these people.
Yeah, there certainly is. I think the billionaire gangster elite recognizes that they've screwed up the world, but they want to, you know, they're all pursuing their own interests and they can't stop. And you know, the people who rise to those positions tend to be extremely greedy. They tend to be pretty competent, pretty sharp, but kind of sociopathic. And they just want to keep playing that game. Each one of them wants to be the winner as much as possible of that game. But at the same time, I think they recognize that they are making the planet unlivable. They are making their societies unlivable and ungovernable. And, you know, there's this new, very interesting book out by Douglas Rushkoff, who's been on my radio show. He's one of my favorite sort of left-leaning Jewish thinkers. I've debated things with him and I actually end up agreeing with a lot of what he says. His latest book is called Survival of the Richest, and it's about the billionaires and near billionaires buying up gigantic survival compounds, you know, building tennis courts and bowling alleys underground and you know, building self-contained bubbles underground where they think they can live out the event, they call it, the event with a capital E, meaning whether it's a biowar, destruction of most of the population and all the infrastructure, whether it's nuclear war in an asteroid, whatever, they think it's coming and they're building these survivalist compounds to deal with it. And Rushkoff points out that they understand that their way of life, their way of ruling the planet has, you know, it's pushing the planet towards total cataclysmic destruction. And yet they can't stop, and they can't stop themselves from having these fantasies of being the one lone survivor in their billionaire underground compound. And it's kind of pathetic. It's kind of humorous. It reminds me of sort of John Ronson's books like The Men Who Stare at Goats. I think Rushkoff kind of captures something there about the pessimism, really, of these billionaire elites who are on top of the world, these, you know, sociopathic types who've gotten everything, and they are torn between wanting more and more and more, and then realizing that everything they've done has basically, you know, destroyed the world, and that there's only a disaster looming in front of them. And it's quite an amusing and enlightening read. And I think that really is the situation. This corrupt Western gangster oligarchy foresees the end of its reign, and perhaps the end of the whole current civilizational system, and is responding irrationally and with bizarre fantasies, you know. And we get into transhumanism as one of those bizarre fantasies, and there are others, but I know we're getting towards the end of the hour, so I'll cut it short, and we'll talk about that some other time.
Yes, well, I think actually, I don't know if it was the last show we did, we actually talked about transhumanism, so it's something we've talked about before. But yeah, no, we covered a lot of ground. I want to thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Great article in American Free Press. Do keep up the great work, and once again, I would encourage listeners to subscribe to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Check out AmericanFreePress.net for those details. And Dr. Barrett, thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Okay, you too, John. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye. Bye.